Welcome to the Angry Admins Podcast for January 23rd, 2007, episode number 12. Welcome back, everyone. This is the Angry Admins Podcast. My name is Ryan Necessary.
And I'm Joe Bibby.
In this show, we discuss technology in the workplace, gadgets at home, and where we think information culture is headed. Joe, what do we have on the radar this week?
First thing on the radar, we've got a story about KDE 4 gaining full Mac OS X support. The reason this is kind of a big deal is that in the past, KDE has been able to run on OS X, but they're going for full support for the KDE 4 release. And basically what you'll do is you'll be able to install a set of background tools and your KDE apps will then be able to run in the standard OS X interface.
Nice.
So this is good because there's a lot of people that like the KDE apps. There's big fans of Conqueror and some of the other KOffice. And there's a lot of apps out there for KDE. And being able to add those to the list of supported apps in OS X is a pretty big deal in my book, just in that it's just another reason that OS X is good in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I like OS X, and having more free apps available is a good thing.
Right. Well, also, like you say, gives you some options. You know, if you're not totally happy with the, the normal OS X stuff, then do you think this is going to pull away more Linux users into the Mac world?
Or? I could see it doing that. You know, the reason there's some people I'm sure that are fighting this move because, you know, people are kind of in the OSS world are all about, you know, we got to keep it all on free, every free apps on free OS.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there are people fighting this, but the more I use OS X, the more I realize how much it is like Linux. I mean, we'll talk about this later, but I compiled an app this week that it was just like compiling it on Linux.
All right. In your opinion, would you say that KDE has kind of eclipsed GNOME, or do you think they're still neck and neck?
I would say they're still neck and neck, especially with Ubuntu kind of being gigantic and using GNOME as its main base. You can get the Kubuntu KDE version, but I think GNOME is pretty neck and neck with KDE. But KDE is kind of the history. It's been around for a long time, and there's a lot of people who love it. So.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Next on the radar, there is a story about we saw on Beta News. It looks like Microsoft statistics show that 1 in 5 machines that come to their site to try to download updates is not genuine. So, you know, a couple of years back, they did the Windows Genuine Advantage, which basically meant that you had to have a good copy of Windows that, you know, you bought, and you had to have a legitimate license in order to download patches, which maybe a bad thing for all the infected computers out there. So I'm not sure if they're really doing us a disservice by forcing that on all the users. But anyway, it looks like that about 22% of the machines that hit Windows Update are not validated as an official copy. And they also said that Beta News reported that the Business Software Alliance had some numbers showing that across the world, about 1 in 3 about 1 in 3 copies of all software is pirated. So 30% of everything on every computer in the world, you know, it's like, so 1 in 3. Yeah, that seems high to me.
Well, you know, I would probably think that, except that I know, especially in like Taiwan and China, there are stores that are 12 stories tall, and it's all pirated software that you can get for $1, $2.
Right.
So, you know, it seems like once you leave kind of the Western culture of the U.S. and, like, you know, the U.K. and Western Europe, copyright just goes out the window. I mean,
I think Russia has a big, you know, big problem with this, too. So I would be interested to see the statistics between the U.S. and, you know, those numbers versus the whole world, you know, and see if there's, like, a big difference. Like, in general, the U.S. tends to have more official copies of software.
So. Well, and there's always this dance between the pirates and the software developers on, you know, it's almost good if your software is pirated a lot, because then when people go into a business, they'll pay for it and actually use it legitimately. But I keep waiting for the Genuine Advantage thing to turn into you can't use this OS unless you register.
Right. The trend that I am liking, and you know, Adobe started doing this, is you get a fully functional copy mm-hmm. that times out.
Yeah.
You know, so sure, give me 10 days, give me a month or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't disable half of your system or put watermarks on my
right.
stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Let me try it. If I really like it, maybe you'll get my money.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
You know, but if you don't get my money, that means that either I wasn't going to buy it anyway, or I only needed it one time and I didn't mm-hmm. want to drop $600 on some photo editing app.
Yeah, so. That's like going back to the big shareware days back in the 90s where everything was shareware and you downloaded it and then you paid $20 later for it. Or you didn't and you just kept using it. But
yeah, I wonder if those guys made any money.
I don't know.
I think that's probably why shareware is not around as much anymore yeah. because I don't think it's a good money making
yeah,
model.
Yeah, it seems like you're either freeware or you're a big business.
Right. So I don't know. What else we got?
So the next story, we have Sun Microsystems making the headlines yesterday, the 22nd of January, in that they announced they're going to now have Intel supported by their Solaris operating system, and they'll be selling hardware with Intel chips.
Hmm.
Now, they've been doing AMD chips for a little while now, but it seems like Intel is just going after all these companies, getting them to switch to Intel. It's like they saw that AMD was gaining on their market share, and they realized, you know, we need to go after these guys. And
mm-hmm.
And then it's like Sun, you know, they were big for a long time, and now they're just trying to grasp at whatever they can. I
right.
know they're still used pretty widely by people, but
mm-hmm. Back in the late 80s to probably mid to late 90s, SGI, Sun,
mm-hmm.
they were like the major business players,
right.
of course, IBM. But here lately, I mean, I know at work we're shutting down the last of our Suns
right.
because the hardware is just too expensive.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, if we're running Linux servers, if I lose a part, I can just go down the street and get a part,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I'm back online in a few minutes. So you just can't beat that.
So it seems like they realize the error of their ways, and so they're going to more generic hardware. I mean, using Intel, it's the Xeon Intels too. Also, it's not the consumer level Intel.
Mm-hmm.
It's the server class, which, you know, not surprising there.
That's cool. I guess it's not good news for AMD, but
right, yeah. So the final story on the radar, we have a story kind of tying back into some old SUSE news we covered back with the Microsoft SUSE Alliance. The first major customer has announced their decision to move towards that, and that is Walmart, which is a gigantic company. Now, this isn't that surprising. There are some notes on Slashdot about this, and that the Microsoft's current COO, Kevin Turner, is actually the former CIO of Walmart. So this actually, you know, this could be where the deal started. They're trying to get Walmart's business, which I'm sure is a big moneymaker for any company. Walmart claims that their reason for moving to the Microsoft SUSE Alliance where is that currently they're using Red Hat and they're concerned about licensing, which seems like they're just blowing smoke to me. But
yeah,
basically Walmart is expanding their web-based coverage kind of worldwide, and so they wanted to roll out several more servers, and now they're moving to Windows Server 2003 and SUSE Enterprise Server.
Hmm.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if Microsoft and Novell kind of cut them a deal about they would maybe customize some applications for them.
I'm sure that's a big part of it. I mean, if you think about it, for Microsoft, this is perfect because this deal gives people the ability to slowly migrate back to Windows.
Mm-hmm.
They can make a deal and have interoperability between SUSE and Windows and then be like, okay, now come to us completely.
Right, exactly.
Or we'll stop supporting you.
Right. I don't know. I don't buy the whole thing like, oh, we're scared of lawsuits because, you know, Walmart has to command so much financial capital that they can fight off pretty much any lawsuit. So. In the rewind this week, a quick note about a story we mentioned last week. The Pirate Bay trying to acquire Sealand. If you missed last week, there's a micro, I guess you call it a micronation.
Yeah.
Which is a small platform off the coast of the UK. And the Pirate Bay was interested in acquiring that and making that their new base of operations so that they wouldn't be subject to any, you know, nation's laws to continue their BitTorrent hosting and tracking activities. But it looks like the current owner of CLAN has expressed a desire to never sell to them because he feels that, you know, that's not the direction he wants to go. And I think also part of the situation there is that he acquired that under the agreement that he would never sell it in any form or fashion that would harm the UK. So he feels like, well, intellectual property is important, and, you know, he doesn't want to support piracy or whatever. So
okay.
So it looks like, and also I think the current price tag is $1 billion.
For a chunk of concrete. That's awesome.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay $1 billion for it.
No.
But, yeah, so even if Pirate Bay could save that much money, he said it's not for sale to the Pirate Bay. So, sorry, guys. That was a good idea, but maybe find another island somewhere.
Well, at least they got some free publicity out of the whole thing.
They did. So, too bad.
In the toolbox this week, we're going to start it off with a free offering from Microsoft. Vista is about to be released for consumers, and because of that, Microsoft just released a website called Windows Vista Test Drive. And this is pretty cool stuff. You can go to this website. It requires Windows 2000 or XP, and you have to have IE 6 or 7, which is not surprising. And it installs a little ActiveX control, which once that loads, you get a full-blown version of Windows Vista. Now, you have to choose... There's kind of these little tasks that they want you to go through, and then you click test drive after it shows you how to do the task, so then you can go try out the different unique parts of the software.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice about this is it's Vista, and you don't have to install it, you don't have to download the beta hacked copy from Pirate Bay.
So it's like running in a window, right?
Yeah, so it's running in a window in your browser.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not full screen, so... And it's going to be a little slow because it's over the network.
Mm.
But so, you know, even just that by itself, I thought was pretty neat. You know, yeah, we will check out Vista before it's released. There's also Office 2007 installed on the Vista machine you connect to, which I hadn't really seen Office yet, the new version. I'd seen some stories about it, but I thought it was pretty neat to go in there and kind of click around, see the new ribbon interface, and just kind of play with it a little bit. So I would suggest going to check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes for that.
Cool. Yeah, I tried to get to them this morning, and it was a little slow. I don't know if they were just getting hit by a lot of traffic.
Yeah, well, it was just released on the 22nd, so I think a lot of people are getting... I'm sure it got dug and slash dotted and whatever.
All kinds of stuff, yeah. Yeah, the thing I saw this week was Google Earth 4 came out a couple weeks ago,
right.
So I just wanted to mention that. Downloaded it and tried it. I actually threw it on my Mac. I haven't put it on my PC yet. Pretty cool. It's still sort of the same Google Earth. It still does a lot of the same. It looks like they've ditched the bottom bar, which before was like all the, you know, how to move around and tilt.
Mm-hmm.
Now it looks like most of that's middle mouse based.
Okay.
Which I'm not totally crazy about, but, you know, I'm kind of a clicker.
Yeah, you're a clicker.
I'm a clicker type guy, more than a hotkey type guy. But now they're supporting a few new things, including a lot of the buildings, the 3D buildings, if you turn those on. Now a lot of those will either have textures or give you the ability to texture those.
Oh, nice.
So it adds a little... You know, some
nice little detail,
and then you can also create using the SketchUp stuff that Google acquired.
Wow!
So you can create your own buildings and 3D landmarks, you know, within Google Maps and save those. Another feature that they have now is the points of interest. Now you can click on them, and it will pop up like a little Java pop-up window, and it'll have a full color photo of, like, say, the front of the museum and some of the information about that. Or, you know, if you go to the Eiffel Tower, there'll be like a color photo there that will pop up when you click on that. And there are other points of interest, which when you pop them up, there's more like web links.
Mm-hmm.
So to get, you know, to follow into more info about those things, then they're kind of bringing it back more into the web.
Yeah.
You know, I would say this is Google, you know, letting you do more to Google Maps and also reintegrating it with hypertext. So I think it's a good move.
So it sounds like they're, you know, when it first was released, you know, I used it like crazy because it's like, hey, look at this cool little utility. You click here and it'll like zoom out and go around the world. And it was kind of a little toy.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like now they're turning it into something useful where you can, I mean, I could imagine if you're, you know, say you've got, you're going to set up camp somewhere and you want to lay out your camp in a real satellite picture using those polygons. I mean, you could do a full layout using the textures, and you can even see your height with the that little feature in there. I don't remember what it's called, mm-hmm. but
all the elevation.
Yeah, all the elevation stuff. I mean, that's pretty useful. That's a pretty big addition mm-hmm. there, being able to draw your own tool.
Well, I think they really are trying to take it more back into the collaboration direction. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole, I'm not even going to say Web 2.0.
No, don't do it.
But, yeah, so it's more about, you know, you can draw street routes mm-hmm. and, you know, show that to folks. And so, I don't know, it's pretty cool. It was always, it was always a neat tool, but I'm glad to see that they're keeping up with it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of nice.
For the main story this week, we wanted to return to our network coverage, our network scanning coverage. Macworld and CES finally wrapped those up last week, so we're going to resume our regularly scheduled programming. So where we left off, we had covered some basically some wired network utilities to improve your traffic and test your VPN traffic and that kind of thing. And so we wanted to kind of move on into the wireless realm this week. And to start us off, we're going to cover some kind of wireless security analyzation software, to put it in a positive light. The major one is actually on Linux. It's called Kismet, and that's kind of the one that everybody is familiar with if you're into this kind of thing at all. And you team that up with Aircrack. Both of those are Linux apps, and basically what those do is Kismet is a wireless sniffing utility that lets you grab some of those wireless packets out of the air and kind of compile them into a file, and then you use Aircrack to attempt to crack your web key and see how vulnerable your access points actually are. But what we're going to actually focus on is a software for OS X called Kismac, M-A-C, that basically combines those two apps into a nice little setup. Basically what you do, you start this software up and it will start to cycle through all the 11 wireless channels and detect all the access points, including access points that have hidden SSIDs.
Nice.
And then what it'll do is, after a certain number of packets, and they actually recommend, I think it was like 1 million packets.
Which, yeah, there has to be like a certain number of packets of interest.
You know? Right, so you get a certain number of packets of interest, which are the ones that kind of contain the web key. Mm-hmm. And then you can actually crack the web key, these softwares are actually a big reason why everybody moved to WPA. But in this version of Kismet, there's actually WPA cracking built in.
Mm-hmm.
Now it takes much, much longer, and if you have any sort of a decent WPA key, you're not going to be able to crack it within like years. So basically, that's just a reminder for those of you out there with wireless access points. Make sure you use a good long string of characters that are kind of randomly generated that aren't in a dictionary. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing built into this software is a dictionary brute force attacker.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just run, you just download some different dictionary files and you run a brute force attack and it'll just cycle through those. So, you know, this stuff is so easy to use. We just want to warn you guys out there, make sure you don't use dictionary words. Anything in the dictionary, it's going to be easy to go through. I mean, that's within 5 minutes. You're going to be able to get that cracked.
Wow.
So word of warning out there. But I want to go into a little more detail on Kismac. It's a little hard to install if you have one of the new Intel Macs. You have to actually compile it, because the driver for basically what you have is, you have an active mode for your wireless card and you have a passive mode. In active mode, it'll be pretty obvious what's going on, and if you are monitoring, you're trying to do this kind of on the sly, you're not going to want to do this in active mode, because if the admin over those access points is worth anything, he's going to know what's going on. So compile it up. You can get it right from their website and compile it right in your terminal there in OS X, which is pretty fun to do. This is actually my first time compiling an app in OS X, and I felt pretty good. I don't know. Made me feel like it was a powerful OS again. I was getting kind of used to it, but
yeah.
You see Kismac opened up, and you see your list of access points. It gives you their MAC addresses, tells you how it's encoded. Again, this is OS X only. And basically, you just sit there and let it run. Some of the downsides to it, it kind of takes over your network driver, so you can't browse the web or do anything else while this is going on. So that's something to watch out for. And actually, I've had some times where I've actually had to reboot after closing because it doesn't release the driver. So, you know, kind of watch out for that. You know, again, this is an alpha release. It's version 0.21. So it hasn't been around long enough for them to really make it super stable. And I think part of the reason that it's a little rough around the edges is because these new Intel Macs, they had to kind of rewrite the driver software for it. So if you have a PowerPC Mac, you're set to go, or you can buy some of the aftermarket cards with the Prism driver in it.
Yeah. Being that it's for Mac, is it like a beautiful interface? And
it's not fantastic. I mean, it's pretty nice though. I mean, it takes advantage of OS X, and you know, you have a nice window. And whereas Kismet for Linux, I think, is kind of mostly text-based interface. So you know, you can watch it as it's going through, and you can click on each one and get more details about each access point.
Cool.
So just one more thing I wanted to cover, and then we will move on. There's a new feature that they just added. I think either it was this release or the one previous. If you have one of these Prism-based aftermarket cards, you can actually do what they call wireless injection. And what this does is it sends some test packets out to either a client or the access point, kind of fools it into sending a ton of traffic your way, and speeds up the cracking process significantly. Still in pretty serious development, but something to watch out for if you're in the security field. This is something that's going to really speed up these cracking, and so it's always good to keep yourself in the know.
Yeah. Back on the Windows side of things, the one that I think is pretty popular out there is Network Stumbler. And I've got it running on my old Toshiba over here. Joe and I, what has it been, like a year since we did any war driving? But this was our war driving setup with my little handheld GPS unit. Net Stumbler is pretty good. Basically, it's a nice tool, Windows native. It doesn't support every card, but as of the last release, which they haven't updated in a while, but it does support quite a few cards. As far as the Wi-Fi cards, it does a good job at just identifying access points. It'll show you their MAC and the SSID, and you know, a lot of things about, you know, signal noise ratios, and you know, a lot of numbers if you care about that. And then you can, you know, click on each access point, and it'll give you a signal strength meter. So it's nice if you want to find, say, even in your own stuff, like, well, you know, I got folks in my organization who, you know, their laptops drop out if they go to this conference room. You know, what's wrong with that? Well, you could walk around with this laptop like that and find, oh, well, I'm cutting out here, so I need to put a repeater in the hall, or, you know, things like that. It, like, as I mentioned before, it does integrate well with GPS, so it will give you a lat long within the tool, so that you can export a text file with all that. And there's actually quite a few tools out there to take all that text and then map it on a top-down 2D map. So, you know, if you were to go war driving and you wanted to have like a top-down map of all the access points that you found, then, you know, it's pretty easy to export that out and then save those sessions. So it's pretty good for that. I got it running right now. It looks like, other than mine, I see three other access points in the apartments here, one of which is not secured. So if you're my neighbor and you listen to this podcast, secure your stuff. You know who you are.
Yeah, you know, NetStumbler is really a good, nice little app. And the other thing that I like about it is that it's not meant to hack.
Right.
You know, it's really, all it's designed for is to show you if there's access points open and ready to be used, or if they're secured. And it's useful for a lot of things if you're, you know, you kind of went over that already. And so just as a little tip for our Mac users out there, there is a version of NetStumbler called iStumbler for the Mac if you don't want to have to compile your own app and mess with all that. Plus, if maybe you're worried about people thinking you're doing some shady business, this is kind of the same line, but for the Mac. So
yeah, I wish they would make a new version, though, because, like, see, I do WPA encryption,
right?
But it still identifies mine as WEP, you know. So yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good thing, because they'll be thinking they can crack any easy WEP key that's
could be.
not there.
The iStumbler version just kind of says secure or open. So Yeah. But it does have some other features, like you can scan Bluetooth and some other things with the iStomper for the Mac.
Yeah, so. It's pretty good. I remember about 6-7 months ago, we used some NetStumbler laptop. I think it was actually with this laptop.
Mm.
And we were trying those different antennas. You remember?
Yeah.
We tried different dipole.
Trying some long-range directional antennas at work.
So, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's good because it shows you single signal strength and some various other things kind of help you figure out what the best way to go is.
Yeah. What else we got on this?
So the final tool we have for your wireless scanning pleasure is a tool, I think it was maybe you that discovered this, Ryan, but we've been using this for about a year. It's a little utility called YSpy, and we'll have a link in the show notes, but I think you're all going to want one of these, because what it is it's a $99 2.4 gigahertz wireless spectrum analyzer.
Mm.
Now, when you talk about a spectrum analyzer, generally you're talking $1,000 or more.
Right.
Now, of course, those scan a greater range, but this is very much targeted at your someone who is trying to set up a wireless network and you're looking for interference. Basically what you'll see is you'll see a waveform running, and you can specify, you know, it shows you the channels on the bottom, or you can show just the hertz, the frequency, and what this will let you do is look, see. So if you're trying to set something up on channel 11, you see a big spike when your equipment is off, you know, well, there's something else out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, NetStumbler and these other apps may not necessarily see everything because there's mobile phones, you've got Bluetooth, microwaves, all this other traffic that's going on the same 2.4 gigahertz range.
Right.
That's not going to show up as a wireless access point.
Mm-hmm. Now tell them what it looks like.
So this is the other cool thing. So you think network, a spectrum analyzer, you're thinking like a big brick book looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is as small as the smallest USB thumb drive.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking tiny. You just drop this thing in the side of your laptop. You can even run the software right off the CD, so you don't even have to install anything.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very nice. Little, you know, I'm sure the people that made it didn't spend much time developing it, but it was just this nice little niche that I think needed to be filled. And, you know, you can throw it in your laptop bag and it doesn't take up any space.
Yeah, I think we've already used it a few times because, like, when you went to the convention center,
yep.
We're setting up for the team and we have all kinds of, you know, you like 40, you know, 40-something teams with our groups with Wi-Fi access points there, and you're trying to find, man, how am I going to have any bandwidth left?
Right.
So.
Well, and so we used it. This kind of just a little side note story. They had talked before they called me in. They had talked to the convention center, and they all said, "Oh yeah, we're only on channel 11, so you know you guys should be fine there on channel 1 or 6." So they changed channels, and still it was the same thing. So I bring in the YSpy and NetStumbler, and I'm throwing those on there, and I'm thinking, "Wow, I see stuff on 1, 6, and 11, three devices on each channel, and they're all transmitting at pretty high power."
Mm.
So whoever they talked to didn't know what they were doing, and that's why they should call us in earlier, because we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Got to call in the angry admins.
That's right. No, that is very well worth $99.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'd buy one all day long for that. So, very cool tool. But it is only 2.4 gigahertz.
Yeah, and it's only going to show you the range of, I think, channels 1 through 11. And it may go, like, to 12 or 13 because there's some... And in Europe, I think they can go beyond channel 11. But yeah, it's definitely focused for your 802.11 traffic.
Mm-hmm. So. And it has a few other little side tools, like it lets you save.
Yeah, you can save stuff for later viewing and actually play back your scan in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And it saves it to, I think it's a CVS file that you could open up in a database. And you know, so they kind of let you use it for whatever you want, which is very nice. Site of the week. For our site of the week, we have a network-related site. A few weeks ago when we were talking about network scanning, we talked about Traceroute, one of the standbys of any network admin. And we found a nice little website called Visual Traceroute. And what this is, a free online Visual Traceroute where it will actually, you enter your IP, and you can either choose to start the traceroute from the server they're running on or from your own IP. And it will do a traceroute, but it'll show it on the map, and it will give you IPs along the way, a nice little performance graph. It's a pretty nice little website. We actually were going to feature it a few weeks ago, but it was down at the time, so it seems to be hit or miss, so watch out for that. But this is something I would recommend checking out. You know, it's not the most beautiful design, but it's very effective. Kind of the throwback to, I think there used to be an app called like NeoTrace or something. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, Visual Trace Route. They've been around for a few years.
Have they?
I stumbled on these guys a few years back, and the site, they've done a little more with the site now, because it'll even tell you while you're doing the trace route, it'll show you the different each point that, you know, that it takes a hop. It'll tell you that this point is, you know, performing erratically, and it'll give you the range of statistics for each hop, and of course it'll map, you know, geographically, you know, as you jump, which is usually what you're interested in. And is it really that useful? I would say sometimes. I think, you know, if you want to know if your traffic is taking a long way around to get to something, I think it's more of just an interesting thing to see, you know, where your traffic is. And a lot of times, if you have a web host or something, you may not be sure where that is. You know, it's like, well, I know I'm hosted with this company, but where's their data center? You know, so it is interesting to see that. They have, you can do it online, and they also have some purchase versions.
Yeah, I think you can buy, the app, but I just use it online. I mean, it's not something I would want to pay for. You can try it for free for 15 days, XP 2000 only.
What was it, like $50 or $100 to buy it?
Yeah, it's something right around there.
I want to say that's how much it was. And then actually,
$50.
You can, I think for quite a bit more, you can run a Visual Trace Route server.
Yeah, they let you buy the actual server side of the app for $395, looks like, $395. Yeah. So one thing I use this for a lot, actually, is if someone's hitting my website and I just kind of want to see where they're at, I just throw this in there and kind of see where we're getting traffic from.
Okay, folks, we're going to wind down for this week. That's going to wrap up episode 12.
Episode 12.
Wow. Okay.
3 months of Angry Headnets.
That's it. As always, feel free to stream the podcast straight from our site at angryadmins.com, or look us up on iTunes, where they're also. We have some new forums out, and we're going to have a thread for each episode.
That's right.
So as we find follow-up information or corrections or retractions or apologies in my case,
whatever,
we'll post all of those things there. We'd like to give a thank you to Kristen and Zach and for their recent contributions to the show.
That's right.
And welcome to some of our listeners that have recently joined us via Daily Cup of Tech.
That's right.
And the link's over on that site. Great site. Feel free to submit anything you want. Let us know. Feedback@angryadmins.com is our email address. And feel free to stop by our website and hang out all you want. Until next week, I am Ryan Necessary.
And I'm Joe Biddy.
And stay angry.